belly fat is some bad stuff.
If you're doing CPR, should it be continuous or interrupted, or does it matter?
What about that really tight blood pressure control?
And what do the studies show about the long-term health effect of silicone breast implants?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. Posted on November 13th, 2015, I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I think we should start with this issue of tight blood pressure control and its benefits, or maybe not so much. That's in the New England Journal of Medicine, something that we preempted a little bit a couple months ago, and now we've got these published details.
This has been a moving target, to say the least, Elizabeth. And it's because previous studies have suggested that lowering the blood pressure too low or more intensive blood pressure control in older patients might have more adverse effects, that lowering it too intensively in diabetics wasn't particularly beneficial either. So the recommendations have been changing. So this is a very large, very well done study trying to address the issue of whether we should have more intensive versus standard blood pressure control in individuals that are at risk for cardiovascular disease, but don't necessarily have it. This is over 9,300 patients with a blood pressure that was elevated at baseline, over 130 millimeters of mercury, that's the systolic pressure. They had an increased cardiovascular risk, but they did not have diabetes. They had not had a previous stroke. And they put them on standard blood pressure control, that is to keep their blood pressure target below 140, or more intensive blood pressure therapy to keep it below or at 120. Both groups started out with a very similar blood pressure to begin with, about 138 or 139 at baseline. At the end of 1 year, those in the standard group was down to about 136. Those with more intensive blood pressure treatment down to 121. And those, by the way, that had the more intensive blood pressure therapy were less likely to suffer one of the adverse outcomes. Combination of stroke, heart failure, heart attack, death from cardiovascular disease, or acute coronary syndrome decreased it by 25%, decreased the risk of heart failure by 38%, death from cardiovascular disease by 43%, or death for any reason by 27%. The downside, the rates of serious adverse effects such as low blood pressure, fainting, electrolyte abnormalities, and acute kidney injury or failure were higher.
What about quality of life? We're well aware, of course, that people who are in intensive regimens for keeping their blood pressure under control often report that they just don't like the way they feel.
They didn't address that particular outcome, but here's what they did note. For the more intensive blood pressure therapy, it required you to take on average 3 medicines instead of 2, more intensive follow-up from your physician. Only about 40 or 50% of patients met their target as well.
And I think what I'm going to conclude here is that we still don't have the final answer, because I'd like to see a longer-term follow-up with regard to these outcomes.
This is a little over a 3-year follow-up, but even then, they stopped the study prematurely because the benefits were really so substantial, and the opinions of the investigators outweighed any of the adverse side effects associated with it. This applies to older individuals, not those under the age of 50. It doesn't apply to diabetics, doesn't apply to people with strokes, but the benefits seem to be pretty substantial.
Since we're in the New England Journal of Medicine, then let's turn to something else I think is also, we've talked about a number of times, a moving target. What about continuous versus intermittent CPR?
The recommendations have changed a bit. Currently, that it's more important to do compressions than it is to do breathing, to interrupt the compressions to do breathing, I should say. That's based on a lot of observational studies and some animal studies, but there's really never been a randomized trial that said, okay, if you're doing standard compressions 100 times per minute with asynchronous breathing, someone's putting a mask on the individual's face and breathing for them, but you never interrupt it, versus doing the old type of CPR where you do 30 compressions, stop, do 2 breaths, resume compressions for 30 times, 2 breaths, you don't interrupt it for more than 5 seconds, whether that's really any worse or not. And that's exactly the 2 strategies studied here. This was a large trial, Elizabeth. There were over 114 different emergency medical services agencies that were involved. Almost 24,000 patients were included in the study. And they looked to see what their outcome was, how many of them survived to hospital discharge, and how many of them survived without neurologic injury. Overall, about 9 to 9.5% of the individuals that underwent CPR by either of the 2 techniques survived until discharge. And those that survived with favorable neurologic function, about 7% to 7.5% in both groups.
Sounds to me, of course, that for simplification of the regimen, that the continuous CPR sounds like the best strategy.
Well, what I'd say is, since both appear to be equivalent or similar, whichever one you're most comfortable doing is probably the most important thing. I know you don't like that answer because you'd like to say, well, one or the other, but sometimes the circumstances dictate or people are more comfortable with one more than the other. A couple of things I would say is it's important to do adequate chest compressions, and it's important that the delay, the interruption, not be terribly long. Either one of them is perfectly fine, Elizabeth.
I think that with regard to especially bystander initiated CPR, we got to simplify it and we have to standardize it.
Well, in fact, this really doesn't apply as much to bystander CPR. I agree with you. The most important thing is to start chest compressions. This is for emergency medical agencies that have the opportunity to also do breathing as well. If you're a bystander and someone goes down, they don't have a pulse, you need to initiate CPR. Chest compressions 100 times per minute is the most important thing.
On that note, let us turn then to something that provides a risk for having to have EMS and resuscitation. That's abdominal fat. We're looking at Annals of Internal Medicine. Oops, turns out that that donut shape around the belly, not a good thing.
So Liz, we spent a lot of time talking about obesity, the fact that there are over 2 billion people worldwide that now have obesity. We've talked before about the fact that central obesity ends up being a higher risk factor than peripheral obesity. That is, having a large waist compared to your hips, or what's called a waist to hip ratio. These investigators did a very interesting thing. What about individuals that really aren't obese? They have a normal body mass index, yet they still have an abnormal waist to hip ratio. Does that increase your cardiovascular risk? They looked at over 15,000 individuals that had already completed surveys in what's called the NHANES, National Health and Nutrition Examination Surveys. They identified those that were obese and had central obesity, and those that were normal but still had a high waist to hip ratio. And what they discovered, if you're a man and you have a normal BMI, but you have a high waist to hip ratio, your mortality risk was twice as high as somebody that did not have central obesity. And by the way, was higher than those that were overweight or obese, just based upon BMI alone. A very similar thing for women. If they had a normal weight, but central obesity, they had a 50% higher mortality than those that had a normal BMI and no central obesity.
I think it's difficult, of course, for somebody who has what is a normal weight by the tables to be told that, wow, you've got this belly fat. You're going to need to get rid of that somehow in order to reduce your risk.
Well, and I think there are a couple of messages. That's one of them, is that even though it appears that you're normal weight, we need to talk about doing things that reduces the central obesity. The other thing it tells us is that since these people are at higher risk, these are the people we should target for other risk reduction therapies as well.
Indeed. It also, of course, suggests that there's a mechanism that's different with regard to this particular distribution of fat and subsequent risk.
You're right. And we know that central obesity in those that have increased weight is associated with a higher risk of having metabolic syndrome. So your point's well taken.
Excellent. Finally, then, let's turn to another issue that has been ongoing for, indeed, decades. Silicone breast implants. We've seen a major company tank as a result of lawsuits secondary to their use. Now we have a study again in Annals of Internal Medicine taking a look at, do we really have any evidence that there's a problem with these devices?
There have been more than 400 case reports in series that have tried to link silicone breast implants with various health conditions. When you look at the data in toto, is there any clear link between adverse health outcomes and silicone breast implants? These investigators tried to address that by systematically reviewing the literature regarding specifically long-term health outcomes in women with silicone gel breast implants. They looked at things like breast cancer, connective tissue disease, rheumatologic diseases, autoimmune diseases, neurologic diseases, even reproductive issues. 32 different studies in 48 publications. What they found out is that there was insufficient evidence to associate breast implants with any of those disorders. There's no consistency among the studies. What you'd like to know is that there are several studies that all point in the same direction. So at most, there could be a weak association between a decrease in cancers and an increase in autoimmune disease, but that was very weak. So I almost hesitate to report this because we'd like to nail things down. This is one of those times where we say, well, gosh, we really have insufficient studies. If we really want to address this, we need to do better and more studies.
And of course, those studies are underway because most women who have these silicone breast implants currently, and in fact, for the last couple decades, are enrolled in trials specifically designed to say, is there really a relationship between these devices and the development of chronic disease?
what I'd say is they're actually involved with registries, because we took them off the market in 1992, and then they reemerged in 2006 with the caveat is these women should be involved with the registry to better address this issue. Stay tuned, but right now the data are insufficient. So Elizabeth, which one of the studies do you want to highlight on the blog this week?
This week I'm going to do the abdominal fat and its propensity to increase risk for folks in annals. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.